ages I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bear.
It's extremely Orwellian. I mean, I've never seen anything quite so peculiar as an anti-terror march where you've got the biggest terrorists on the planet leading it.
And gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go right.
You're listening to episode 705 of Unwelcome Guests, Terrorists Against Terror. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard Tony Gosling. We're going to be hearing a lot more from him. Our main piece is a two-hour interview, which I've very slightly cut down to fit in and to remove hesitations and so on. If you're a regular listener, you might be surprised that we're covering a current event. Well, we won't be looking in great detail at the circumstances of the shooting itself. This is a wide-ranging interview, using the Charlie Hebdo shooting as a focus, looking at the pattern of terrorist incidents, so-called, which never tend to be put in much context by the commercially controlled media, often seem to be interestingly timed as regards particular votes on expanding of police powers, rolling back civil liberties and so on. So Tony Gosling will be trying to put this shooting in context. What do we know and what are we not being told? So, to set the scene for those of you like myself who don't normally follow the commercially controlled media, I thought it would be worth highlighting their transparent hypocrisy in reporting. And this piece by Abby Martin from Russia Today does exactly that.
So with the attack on satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo and subsequent hostage crises in France dominating cable news for the past few days, a horrific event in Nigeria has barely received a passing mention. On Wednesday of last week, members of the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram attacked the border town of Baga, slaughtering women, children, the elderly, and anyone else who couldn't escape in time. According to Amnesty International, as many as 2,000 people were killed in the massacre, representing the deadliest attack in the group's history. Think about that for one second. 125 times more people were killed in Baga than Paris, yet somehow only the loss of innocent Europeans is worthy of reporting. Even more disturbing than the willful ignorance and disproportionate coverage of the two events is that Nigeria's president, Good Luck Jonathan, has refused to say even a single word about the bloodbath that took place in his own country. Yes, Good Luck Jonathan somehow found the time to express his condolences for the victims in France, yet was too busy gearing up for his next political campaign and celebrating his daughter's wedding to even bother acknowledging the mass murder of thousands of his own civilians. So just maybe it's time to rethink the $700 million the U.S. sends to Nigeria in foreign aid every year until this man wakes up to reality. But here's a larger point. When we say things like Black Lives Matter, that notion should apply throughout the world, not merely act as a convenient slogan to express outrage within our own borders. Because lives in New York City and Paris matter just as much as they do in Baga. And until Western society collectively comes to this realization, groups like Boko Haram will only continue their butchery under the cover of apathy. It hasn't even been a week since the horrific massacre at the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, and people have wasted no time to proudly proclaim their bloodlust and bigotry, with every channel in the corporate media featuring resident experts on the Islamic faith.
You basically have zones where Sharia courts are set up, where Muslim density is very intense, where the police don't go in, and where it's basically a separate country almost, a country within a country.
You know what it sounds like to me, Steve? It sounds like a caliphate within a particular country.
And in Britain, it's not just no-go zones. There are actual cities like Birmingham that are totally Muslim, where non-Muslims just simply don't go in.
Now, I'm just going to cut in because I did live next to Birmingham for about 10 years. And last time I checked, it has a 20% Muslim population. And in my years of experience visiting there, I've never experienced any problems going in as a non-Muslim.
Sharia courts have been allowed to be established. Prayer rugs in just about every hotel. Is this a major mistake made by France, Europe in general? Are we making that mistake in the United States, not insisting on assimilation?
16% of French citizens support ISIS. Would you describe those who support ISIS as Islamic extremists? Do you support ISIS?
I do hold Muslims responsible to this degree. I don't think that we can solve this problem, Don, until moderate Muslims really speak out, really say, this is not our religion, this is not something we can accept.
See, that last point would be really convenient if only it were true. In reality, you'd be hard-pressed to find a single Muslim organization or community leader that hasn't vehemently condemned the attacks, including some right here on this show. But facts don't satisfy people like Rupert Murdoch, who's hell-bent on insisting that all Muslims are responsible for the actions of a few crazy people who associate themselves with the religion. Not only does this warped mentality scapegoat 1.6 billion people on Earth, but it also washes away the fact that Muslims were victims of the attack as well. And not just victims, heroes. Like Lasana Bathily, an immigrant from Mali who shepherded customers into the freezer to hide while working at the deli under siege. Or Ahmed Maribet, the cop who died confronting the gunmen as they wreaked havoc on Charlie Hebdo's headquarters. There's also little mention of the 33 threats and 21 attacks on Muslim institutions in France in the wake of the massacre, from shooting at Islamic buildings to throwing grenades at mosques. So while pundits like to blame Islam for not understanding the right to free speech, remember that Ahmed worked to defend the magazine's right to mock his religion every day, and in fact died doing just that. But moderates aren't the only Muslims who have condemned the attack. So-called radical Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah publicly declared that extremists hurt Islam more than cartoons. See, insisting on collectively punishing one-fifth of the world's population invokes an arrogant colonial attitude that only seems to be leveled in the wake of Islamic terrorism. When the truth is that no Muslim should have to condemn an attack that has nothing to do with them. If a person's psychotic enough to go and kill people, they'll find reason. And amidst the nonstop media coverage of Islam's inability to laugh at itself, there's been little mention of the fact that countries across Europe already place restrictions on freedom of speech. In France, those limitations have disproportionately targeted Muslims, whether it's banning the niqab headscarf in public or certain pro-Palestinian demonstrations, or denying the Holocaust. Yes, in many EU countries, legislation exists that criminalizes Holocaust denialism and anti-Semitism, a slippery slope that some say could include criticism of Israel, which is why the greatest irony of all is that Charlie Hebdo itself fired a columnist in 2009 for publishing an anti-Semitic cartoon. But hey, they laugh at everyone, right? Look, no matter how reprehensible certain language may be, if you're defending free speech on one end, it better be applied across the board. Of course, acknowledging this unequal reality doesn't serve the mighty clash of civilizations narrative that politicians and establishment media have been peddling since 9/11. The notion that violent tension between Islam and the West is inevitable. Born-again Christian George W. Bush himself said he was on a mission from God when he launched the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, invoking religion many times before enacting murderous policies. Not to mention Eric Prince, former Blackwater CEO of the mercenary force enlisted to carry out America's dirty work, who views himself as a Christian crusader tasked with eliminating Muslims from the earth. Interestingly, I don't remember the outcry about Christian fanaticism causing the deaths of over 1 million Iraqis. Aside from its pure insanity, this type of crusader language only exacerbates the jihadists' belief that they're indeed fighting a holy war with the West, thus justifying their martyrdom. Overall, this attack is not about Islam. It's not about childlike concepts of good and evil. It's about a system that breeds inequality and oppression, the outcomes of which are exploited, the causes complex. It's not a fight between Islam and the West. It's a fight between the most extreme and militarized ideologues on all sides. And too often, innocent people are the collateral damage.
Now, for our main piece, an interview of ex-BBC journalist Tony Gosling by Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire.
Tony, are you there?
Hi, Patrick. Yeah, us investigative journalists are a bit of an endangered species. if people have seen the Sidney Pollack film, they'll get the reference. I think it's called The 3 Days of the Condor. You know, there really is, has been really ever since the 1990s when the British documentary makers at Yorkshire Television, a documentary series called First Tuesday, which was a national series on ITV here, they started to dig into the paedophile scandals to do with the Republican Party, the Franklin scandal, this kind of thing. And
that documentary, that was that aired on TV? Because I saw...
It was never aired, but you see...
It was incredible.
It was produced. In fact, the guy just lives quite close to me. I'm quite happy to put you in touch with him if you want. Tim Tate, the producer of that film, said that it was just amazing the way that the whole British investigative documentary scene collapsed around him after they made that film. It was quite clear that the criminal elite, the power elite, however you want to put them, decided, right, we're going to close down investigative journalism, certainly broadcast investigative journalism in Britain, because there's no way we're going to allow this kind of thing to be aired on television. They've made it for the Discovery Channel. Discovery Channel paid $500,000 for the making of the film. It's called Conspiracy of Silence. You can watch it online. And it's absolutely damning about the use of paedophilia and in the elite circles, basically to blackmail our politicians. So most of the politicians that get to the very top, in one way or other, have been totally compromised and are owned by somebody else. I mean, I think it's still absolutely important to engage in politics and vote and that kind of thing. But don't be under any illusions that the people at the very top of the political parties are actually going to be acting in our interest, because most of them, I think, are scared. And that lack of investigative journalism, I mean, he described it as a very delicate infrastructure of investigative journalism was just dismantled in the early mid-1990s here in Britain, of course, bang on time for 9/11, and no investigative journalism, proper investigative journalism, is done by mainstream media, financed by them at all nowadays. It's just window dressing of one sort or another.
Yeah, and if anybody gets tired of the seriousness of this particular topic and you want to have a little comic relief, I'll be on Crosstalk on RT today, talking exactly what Tony has just been talking about, which is the farce, which is the mainstream media, and talking about some other lighter subjects like the North Korean Sony hack hoax and the interview and so forth. But
well, it's worth saying, Patrick, that you know the Russians are tiptoeing around this one in Paris. It's quite clear.
Yeah.
They don't want to go wading in at the deep end. You know, they haven't been, for example, asking people like me to comment, who know quite a lot about these kind of false flag events that have been going on in Europe over the last 30, 40, really ever since the Second World War. And I suppose that, you know, the one person who needs to get up for putting people like you and I in the picture is the Peruvian-born US filmmaker Alan Frankovich. I mean, he made the three-part documentary series which went out on the BBC back in 1992, 1993, the Time Watch program, which went deeply into Operation Gladio in a way that also scared the criminal elite, scared the power elite, and was another reason why from the mid-1990s onwards, there was a real quite slow strangulation of investigative journalism, even series that in here in the UK that were pulling in 10 million viewers. You would think the advertisers might be interested in that and the network, but no. No, it's all going to be closed down because there is going to be no more investigative journalism of that kind of sort, you know, with teams of sort of 10, 12, 14, plus a barrister working constantly on being the eyes and the ears of the public and effectively a sort of last court of appeal for all of the awful machinations of the establishment to get the word out. And just simply, you know, that doesn't happen nowadays. So it's left to people like you and I. And it's also, it's really quite heartening to see the way that quite a lot of people have been pulling together on the internet to pull this whole thing apart, because there are literally tens of thousands of people, particularly those in Paris today, who went along to a demonstration thinking that what they were doing was standing side by side with the victims of this horrific attack in Paris, but actually found that lo and behold, all the world leaders were leading them. And, you know, they basically hijacked this. Some of the biggest terrorists on the planet have actually decided, Benjamin Netanyahu, David Cameron, and, you know, the whole thing was turned into a Mahmoud Abbas, Netanyahu. Well, those of you who've come out on the streets of Paris to show solidarity with Charlie Hebdo, that you're also basically saying, well, this is all part of the Middle Eastern peace effort, and David Cameron and Netanyahu are leading it. I mean, this is horrific stuff, and it's a hijacking kind of psyop, I think, of literally tens of thousands of people. Now, I'm not saying that Cameron shouldn't go to something like that. All I'm saying is that if you look at the coverage of it, it's been given them a platform for their views and their, and it's extremely Orwellian. I mean, I've never seen anything quite so peculiar as an anti-terror march where you've got the biggest terrorists on the planet leading it.
Well put, Tony. You know, I was just watching before the show. I was watching this on CNN, and I have never in my life seen such a dazzling display of propaganda. I mean, the first Gulf War, second Gulf War, Iraq War was impressive. The Yugoslavian War, that was an impressive display of propaganda. But this is it's a whole lot more sophisticated and multidimensional, which
and
is,
you know what? It's bad journalism, because the biggest terrorist attack by far was the attack in 2011 by the Freemason terrorist Anders Breivik, who went around murdering in Norway. And actually, the number of people he killed is actually quite considerably more than those who were killed in Paris and the London bombings put together. And yet, when we have the coverage here on our so-called wonderful Channel 4 News and British TV here, Simon Israel, their security correspondent, actually completely failed to mention that attack. And he said, oh, well, the biggest attack in Western Europe since 7/7. No, Simon Israel, sorry, mate. Actually, the biggest attack by far was the Breivik attack done by a Freemason Zionist. And actually, there's a really good article by Torstein Vidal. If you come across Torstein's work, he was actually right next to his window. I'm right in saying one of his windows was blown out by the bomb in Oslo that Breivik planted. He wrote a really good book saying, well, actually what Breivik's doing is, and an article too, is equating Zionism with Nazism. And he's a big fan of it all. He's a Knights Templar and he's a Mason. And there's been no real looking into the Masonic lodges that Breivik was involved in. Obviously a perfect place to hide a crime. Everyone's sworn to secrecy on pain of death. And this has been completely missed out from any of the coverage. Unbelievable, really.
Yeah, Anders Breivik, we must be reminded of the severity and scope of that event. And you're right, Tony, that has been completely expunged.
It's also very much in the heart of Western Europe. Actually, you know, Scandinavia is in Western Europe, if you ever look on the maps, reminding our friend Simon Israel on Channel 4 News. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. And it's the same sort of attack as happened the other week, which was considered very horrific. I mean, it is obviously horrific, but the Peshawar school children were murdered. You know, so the idea is to go for the opposition's children. Now, what we're doing here is it's not soldiers fighting soldiers, is it? It's soldiers killing kids. And we're in a whole new world, a cyber war, this kind of asymmetric warfare, and also, of course, propaganda warfare, which is what we've seen today in Paris.
Yes. And speaking of propaganda, I'm going to play you something, Tony. This is a CNN clip. This is when they've basically refashioned. It's a running narrative that changes like Microsoft updates every 15 minutes. They put a new patch in. I'm going to play you one of the patches from yesterday that CNN was running. And basically yesterday they were saying that new sleeper cells have been activated. Oh, hold on. I'll do my impression of Jim Scahuto, CNN's national security correspondent. Hold on. We've just got an update. Breaking update. Sleeper cells have been activated. This is from one of our sources in French security services. This was told to us by our French affiliate. Yes, Muslim sleeper cells have been activated, and it's on high alert. There could be other attacks, could happen at any minute, and so forth. Okay. Now, under the same breath, Tony, they're saying this, and then they show a picture of Netanyahu coming through the hallway saying, and Benjamin Netanyahu is coming to Paris. He's on his way now to be here for the event on Sunday, which is today. And then they say Cameron's coming. So what they've done cleverly, Tony, is they've created this danger scenario. Then they show the world leaders who seem to be bucking danger. In other words, in the face of danger, our world leaders are still coming to Paris. So to me, there's no danger at all, because why would you send all your world leaders if it's on high terror alert and then amass 20 or 30,000 or a million people in one place? So play that clip, Brian, real quick.
I saw in today's New York Times an estimate of 1,000 to 2,000. So the point is that is a very large number. And as you've been reporting, Jim, over the last couple of days. I mean, for each one, in the tier one case of these suspects, I mean, you have 20 individuals that would need to monitor a particular individual. So you do the math. I mean, it's just an extraordinary number of people that you would need to follow around people who are deemed to be dangerous because of this very large group of people who've gone to Syria, including, it seems, perhaps now the girlfriend of. In the tier one case of these suspects, I mean, you have two
attackers there are out there. Sense it lines of 5,000 text, Charlie. So mimicking that now very popular internet hashtag, Je suis Charlie, I am Charlie, I am the magazine saying the city of Paris is. Peter, I wonder if you can help put this latest terror warning into context for our viewers. I was told, for instance, in the last 48 hours by a former head of France's counter-terror services, that there are something along the lines of 5,000 suspected terrorists in France. If you have this warning going out of sleeper cells activated, can you give a sense of how big that threat would be? How many sleeper cells do we just not know? Is it unlikely that even the French authorities know how many potential attackers there are out there tonight?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've seen varying estimates of the number of people, for instance, who've gone to Syria from France. It is the largest group of Westerners who've traveled to the Syrian.
Okay, so Tony, they said, how many terrorists are out there? How many sleeper cells are there? Instead of asking the question, are there actually any sleeper cells at all?
Well, look, it ain't journalism. Whatever you could say, just literally taking what the police and security services are telling you and presenting it as fact. Look, first of all, I mean, if I'm dealing with the police and security services, I want named sources, yeah? Come on, let's have the Director General of the Security Service put his name to what's being said. That's just absolutely basic stuff. And what's been happening over the years, this is just to give people a bit of an insight into how this stuff works, is that over the years, the major correspondents from the London mainstream media are played off against each other. So if they play ball with the security services, they get all the choice stories and they give out the anonymous quotes as fact, that kind of thing. They get the good stories. That's people like the Murdoch Times, you know, and the BBC. And if they don't, then they just simply don't get the stories. When the security services have got a story, they will only talk to their favourites. So they're playing off one network against another. And over the years, they've whittled away the networks and the newspapers' will to actually question anything that they say. I mean, you can't believe it. This is just exactly what George Orwell's talking about, really. And then but that's the method behind the scenes by which the military, to a certain extent, but I mean, you know, the operational military, I think, is another issue compared to the psychological warfare people and the military intelligence, because they are actually rather more sceptical than most of us about what the news media is telling us. I can tell you that certainly most of the military people I know are after the Iraq business and the weapons of mass destruction. Anything that they see on the news or hear from military intelligence, they say, well, where's the evidence? You know, come on, before we risk our lives, we want the evidence now. And this is one of the sea changes that Iraq has brought about, thank God, at least a little bit, in our armed forces. So, you know, there is a tremendous amount of reliance on what those guys are saying. But, you know, this is mostly, I mean, we're in a situation now where there's almost no witnesses left. They were all mown down one way or another on Friday. And so the official story stands. Whatever the anonymous officials, the French security services, internal security services, have told the press is happened. That is, in other words, including things like the identities of people who've been shot, the identities of people who were at the Charlie Hebdo place and filmed at the Charlie Hebdo place. We have really no way of knowing what they're saying is true. We just have to take it all on trust. And there's going to be no trials, it seems, none at all. So no evidence will have to be presented. And really, this is just rule by media as a adjunct of the military intelligence, which in itself has been completely co-opted by the military-industrial complex, as good old Eisenhower warned us, you know, it would do. The timing of all of this, though, Patrick, I think is one of the things which have annoyed me more than anything else that hasn't been discussed at all in the mainstream press, and that is extraordinary that we had back in, you roll back to October last year, we had an attack on the Canadian Parliament with guys who were, it seems, a little bit, shall we say, a bit like Kurt Haskell's guy, on the fringes of society, possibly, you know, with mental issues, that kind of stuff, exactly the same time as the Canadian Parliament was considering its attitude to the NATO actions, which NATO, of course, is supposed to be some kind of consensual organization where everyone agrees. But at the same time as they were, Canadian politicians were deciding their attitude towards all the NATO moves against ISIS. Then we had in December a similar kind of event in Sydney, again, at the same time as the Australian Parliament was considering whether to go along with the NATO moves. One of the bits of news I just heard today, I don't know if you picked this one up, is that at least one of the hostages in Sydney was actually shot dead by police and security services, not by the hostage taker guy there, who, by the way, was, I mean, I don't know if you saw the article in the one of the Sydney papers saying that there were 10 different things that the Australian security services did wrong, including giving the guy a gun license, you know.
Oh, they gave him a gun license.
You have to laugh, really, because if you wouldn't cry, this is exactly the sort of stuff that nowadays is normal. So what you've got is these guys, these nutters of one sort or another, are being handled by radical preachers, often, who are working for the security services, have been turned, been compromised, or simply just love the job. They think it's a bit of a laugh. They're having a joke. But the people who are their victims, who fall for this stuff and who become these crazies, lone crazies, end up dead. So there's no way of connecting them back to the people that have been handling them from security services or private military, whoever it is. And so then you get an event at the right time, which is, it's literally like a kind of sheepdog mentality, and it scares the public, it scares the political classes and the press just at the right time to take the right decision. It's Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, isn't it? I mean, you know, yeah. She has done a fantastic job, I think, in really breaking that down. And even the short little film she made shows you exactly what they're up to, which is a way to control literally millions of people through the media at the right place at the right time. You can get exactly what you want out of them, and there ain't no question of democracy, I'm afraid, with all this. It's just simply what the power elite want, and what they want right now is they want to up the stakes to get as many Western powers behind the NATO actions in the Middle East. And of course, this is also a way of getting everybody behind the actions against the Russians, because it's bringing everybody together into the military fold and actually saying, well, actually, you need, and I'm not talking just about the public, I'm talking about the politicians, particularly the people that make those decisions for us about policy, into the hands of NATO, into the hands of the military, and it puts them in charge. You know, if you're under attack, you need to go to the strong guy and ask him what to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just, yeah, that is the sort of the bigger theme. That's the bigger theme that we're looking at. You're absolutely right. If you're getting bullied in your neighborhood, you either go to your local mob boss or you go to the police. Someone's going to give you protection, basically. And in the case of NATO, this is a kind of multinational, transnational protection racket. That's the only way I can really describe it.
Well, I'd also point out, Patrick, that, you know, I was flicking through a book years ago and it came across, I was just literally sat there gobsmacked looking at it, because there was a picture of Paul Hauser. Now, Paul Hauser, he was a SS general on the Eastern Front, Panzer Corps general during this World War II. But more interestingly, he became the head of the HIAG organization, or ADESA, which is the SS Veterans Association, after the war. In fact, he was helped by the Americans, as it explains in the Frankovich Operation Gladio film that was made for the BBC I mentioned before, as actually having free rein after World War II to basically go around and handle and run and help former SS people who were being protected by the Americans and the Brits in West Germany, basically. And his statement was pretty shocking, which was that the first meetings of NATO were carried out by the international supporters of the SS. And there was quite a big movement, I think, at the end of World War II. General Patton was very vocal about it, saying, well, actually, now we need to go and take on the Russians. So the idea was that some of the units that hadn't been disarmed of the Nazi forces could join forces with the Americans and the British and then go for the real enemy, which was the Soviet Union, you know, and the Soviet armies. But of course, that didn't happen. And I think that there's still that wish to do it. And the question arises, why this obsession with Soviet Russia and Russia, you know? And the answer is pretty damn simple, I think, which is that what the Russians were doing and still are on communism generally, one of the things that they do is that they break up the monopolies. When you've got a water monopoly, electricity monopoly, oil monopoly, car monopoly, these big, big corporations that are doing so well now and avoiding tax all over the Western world, whilst the poor and starving people are actually having to pay tax. I mean, we've got the situation where people with no money have bailiffs knocking on the door telling them you've got to pay your tax. You know, you've got a horrific situation. So, you know, it's those people who are really afraid of just the idea of left-wing stuff, and communism represents that. The communists will not have a great plot to take over the world, but actually what they want to do is they want to break up these massive, powerful monopolies that are in the hands of private families in order to share things out a bit more. And that was the big fear. And that's why the CIA's biggest operation, political operation in history, was in Italy, when the Italian government looked like it was going to bring the communists into a coalition. Now, then that was when Aldo Moro was kidnapped and killed as part of the Operation Gladio by the Brits and the Americans working together with the P2 Lodge in Italy. Basically, what we were doing, we were running a secret government, that every time that the people started to go towards the left-wing side and becoming a little bit friendly towards the communists, basically they would just kill the people involved or kidnap them. And they were running the Red Brigades, basically, the so-called left-wing extremists were being handled and run by Operation Gladio, by the P2 Masonic Lodge in Italy. And that sort of stuff happened in Germany too, with the Baader-Meinhof gang. Actually, you know, getting back a little bit closer to France and Paris, during the 1980s, mid-1980s, there was terrorist training going on in Belgium, as we've heard, funnily enough, just last year in the Ardennes region. They had jihadi training camps, apparently, posing as paintball sessions, actually in the Ardennes region of Belgium. And one of the things that happened, one of the immediate things that I pointed out about this thing is, in Paris, is that we had police being killed by US Marines in Belgium back in the 1980s, because the US Marines were parachuted in as part of Operation Gladio, went into a police station, killed police and stole guns. What they did is they try and make it look, the whole thing look like a left-wing terror group. And so when the massacres had happened in the supermarkets and the bit of money had been taken to make it look like that the country was under attack by left-wing terrorists, so these Marines and probably SAS people too, the Gladio operatives, these fascist right-wing soldiers, under the command of NATO intelligence and the Club of Bern, the Club de Bern, they call it, in from Switzerland. What they did is they then planted those weapons that they'd stolen from the Belgian police in some left-wing squat and then left. So the idea was that there was a sort of trail left, make it look like there was a whole kind of left-wing terror. And you know what? The Belgian people and the Belgian government fell for it, because at the time there was a political thing going on where the Belgians were talking about getting rid of US influence and US cruise missiles. They quite rightly said, well, look, why should we have American nuclear weapons based in Belgium? It just makes us a target. And so they were about to vote to remove them. And these massacres happened at the same time. And the Belgian parliament said, oh, well, we'd better keep our American nukes then.
That brings us to another similar point here, Tony. And you talked about Anders Breivik and the Norwegian massacre. Those chain of events have something in common with Paris, because Norway at the time had made a move to ostracize Israel just prior to that shooting. I think it might have been something related to the BDS type movement.
Well, see, I mean, the kids that were shot were actually part of the growing boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign against the Israelis. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, some of the kids killed were some of them prime movers in Norway in that campaign.
And the children of movers and shakers as well in that country. And they were wiped off the map, as it were, to use an Israeli bit of terminology there. But then only in November, Tony, the French parliament announced that it is likely to vote to recognize a Palestinian state. And of course, they did in December. But Benjamin Netanyahu issued a warning in November saying that would be a grave mistake on the part of the French parliament if they did such a thing. And that warning echoes. It's harrowing right now in my head, looking at what has just happened here in Paris. And I'm not being conspiratorial. I'm just looking at the Norwegian situation, the move against Israel, then the massacre. Then I'm looking at this, the move against Israel, then the massacre. And I'm thinking to myself, well, it's not maybe exclusively Israeli. I mean, I know the intelligence services, and you can comment on this, do subcontract out work to each other and do have sort of common interests between transnational partners. But that, to me, I see that as a strong possibility here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's also well worth looking at the sort of, if you want, spiritual, if you can call it that, connection between these three main powers that have been really, the leading this so-called peace march today, you know, the three biggest terrorists on the planet, basically, Netanyahu and Cameron. I mean, I know Obama isn't there, but he would be if he, you know, in spirit, if he could be. So these three nations, what they're doing is the real serious terrorist threat at the moment is coming from these drones. The idea, we've just had the CIA torture report, haven't we, of course, and Marine Le Pen, the nationalist leader in France, just before Christmas was saying, this is appalling. We want nothing to do with NATO. And this is another side of all of this, is that you've got the French attitude to NATO has been very, very sensible over the decades. 1966, Charles de Gaulle, who the US CIA tried to assassinate. There's the Day of the Jackal, I think the film is, if you've seen that one, Patrick, have you?
Yeah, that's the original, yeah.
It's a horrific film.
Yeah.
And, quite rightly, the Americans, the French said, well, we don't want anything to do with NATO, thank you very much. And they left in 1966. And it was only under Sarkozy that they rejoined in 2009. Yeah, but this club, NATO, is like the Hotel California, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're never allowed to leave it. Sorry. So the idea that Marine Le Pen was putting forward before Christmas, well, that's all gone now. And, you know, you're really in the coalition and you've got to be part of this international community because we're facing this dreadful fear. And so that's I think quite an important angle on all of this that you were saying, you know, that there was essentially a warning going out before Christmas. Come on, the French, you've got to get into line. And if you don't, something might happen. And of course, now it has.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you brought up a point about this big kumbaya, everybody join hands this Sunday in our fight to get behind the pornographers at Charlie Hebdo. I'm sorry, I'm just going to say it as I see it. But and to join hands in defiance of terrorism and to celebrate our freedoms and et cetera. Now, the media is, Tony, what is amazing about this? And this is the most obvious thing that I picked up that probably went over some people's heads. But I see all of the CNN anchors are out there. All of the media are there. There's hundreds of thousands of people in French out there, and they're all getting together. The celebrities have arrived. The world leaders have arrived, and they've just organized this thing, this snap rally. They've got, you know, millions of dollars of printing of vinyl banners and truss rigs set up with staging areas and so forth. And the media is out there covering every single aspect of this gathering, of this protest or rally or whatever you want to call it. And they're saying, look, the world has come together, and they've got satellite events in other cities. And they're saying how wonderful. This has never happened. This is unprecedented. Well, let me tell you something. This is what I'm going to say to Anderson Cooper and Jake Tapper and Christine Amanpour, who's one of the top propagandists in the world. I've seen her shine this week. I was out there in 2003 with 2 million people in London protesting on the eve of the Iraq war. And I did not see, the media did not cover that. There were simultaneous marches all around the world. That is unprecedented.
I think it's a psyop, basically.
They ignored that. They didn't come to cover it. They downplayed it.
I mean, this current one is psychological warfare officers, I think, have been involved in preparing, for example, the hashtag, the banners, this kind of thing. And, you know, if, say, Francois Hollande, or, say, I mean, let's just take it a little bit further. Benjamin Netanyahu had gone on to French television and said, well, please, everybody, come down to the Arc de Triomphe on Sunday. I think you'd probably find only maybe a quarter, a fifth, or whatever, the people would actually be there.
Yes.
What's happened is a kind of trickery, is that, yes, everyone wants to, of course, it's a horrific attack. And, you know, these cartoonists, wherever you think that they're a pornographer or whatever, there's certainly no excuse for goats storming in there and murdering these people.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely disgusting act. But it's been hijacked. It's just simple, and it's the way that this has been done in a sort of premeditated trickery that I find so appalling. Now, back in the Second World War, I'm a big fan of the author, Dennis Wheatley. He was what they called back in World War II in Whitehall here, a deception planner. There is now a massive industry around that. I mean, what he did, for example, was he made the Germans think that the British and the Americans were going to come across at Calais at D-Day. And so the Germans put a fantastic amount of effort into defending Calais and all their top divisions down there. He used things like inflatable tanks, you know, it's quite well known, this. But what there is now around this is a whole massive industry, and it's stretched out not just from the military, right into the media. I remember when one of the MI5 officers back in the 1990s, David Shaler and Annie Machon, blew the whistle on the MI6 funding the jihadis in Libya to try and kill Colonel Gaddafi. Because, I mean, this is a whole other aspect of this, isn't it? You know, Operation Cyclone and Charlie Wilson's War. You know, we rewatched that last night just for the hell of it. What a fantastic film that is, an educational film that gives you an idea of just how close the Americans and the Brits have been to the entire jihadi thing. In fact, they've funded it. It's like a giant kind of corporation that they've funded covertly and created this thing out of nothing. You know, there were a few mujahideen with a few Lee Enfield rifles in Afghanistan, and now they've got all the top kit, they've got all the money. You know, look at ISIS, man. I mean, they are an incredible organization. They've got drug rings, you know, they're selling drugs.
They've got a PR department, marketing department, social media department.
They've got one of the top LA people doing all their PR. You know, listen, they could close down ISIS tomorrow if there was a will. But of course, they need the enemy. They've created this enemy, and that's actually what's at the back of this. What all of this is about making sure that there's a coalition together to fight ISIS, because of course they're not giving up on Syria. Syria is, you know, they really want to take Syria out, and of course this could be the spark of a third world war. The Russians are backing the Syrians, and they've said to them, no, you're not having it. And there's going to be quite a tussle over that country. You know, also the other thing that's been going on at the same time is we were talking about the timing and things to do with the Palestinians, etc. And we've also had this French aircraft carrier now moving to help with the attacks on ISIS. And
absolutely,
this is very important. You know, that hasn't been mentioned in the press. Oh, yes, very, very handy that the French are now absolutely on board. It's pretty amazing that so much, so important context can be missed out. The other thing is this whole jihadi thing. We've heard that one of the preachers that was an inspiration to these brothers, Karachi brothers, in Paris, who is supposedly behind all this, he was a frequenter of Finsbury Park Mosque. Well, you know what that means to me in North London? It means MI6, because the guys at Finsbury Park Mosque, and I've met one or two of them over the years, they were saying, well, back about 2002, 2003, we were phoning up the police saying, will you please get these nutters out of our mosque? Do something about them. You don't have to arrest them, but keep an eye on them and, you know, maybe break up what they're up to, because they are completely crazy. Well, it turned out that the whole thing is a sort of little cell being run by MI6. So who was sitting down with the CIA running Operation Cyclone and the $4 billion poured into that in Afghanistan back in the 1980s. So, you know, this is quite clearly something which intelligence services have had a hand in. And we've just had over the last few months, the two main people from Finsbury Park Mosque, that's Abu Hamza and Haroun Aswat, both of whom, mainly Haroun Aswat actually, were implicated in being the masterminds of the 7/7 London bombings, both been shipped over to you guys in America. You know, so conveniently, if somebody wants to subpoena them here in Britain because they've killed their family, they can't. They have to get them back from America. But they've both been sent down in the US on a completely unrelated charge, even though both of them, particularly Haroun Aswat, I mean, he was phoning the four bombers, alleged bombers, and the 7/7 London bombings in the week running up to the bombs. And most people looking at this from the outside would say this guy is the mastermind. Certainly he should have been tried, arrested, and yet no. I mean, he actually was released twice. I think it was in Pakistan and in Kenya, if I remember rightly, because he'd been traveling around the world because they knew that this guy was Haroon Aswat. He's one of the people who's main wanted people for the 7/7 bombings. And yet he got off scot-free and he was released from both of those places. And then he was put in a mental hospital here in Britain under detention and then shipped to the United States. And yeah, so he's out of the loop. And this is the way they do it. The main people who should be being questioned by the courts get sort of spiraled out. And so they're nowhere near the right place, you know, to actually bring them to justice. And the justice system is just beyond a joke. You know, we had here in London a whole series of individual inquests for 52 dead people. Well, of course, there should have been a public inquiry. That's a traditionally good way of doing that sort of thing. The families are just left feeling, well, what was that all about? And we still don't know what happened to our loved ones. The thing that people, I could tell you now, that people don't know about 7/7 London bombings. I was talking to David Pratt up at the Scottish Sunday Herald in Glasgow. It's a really good paper, the Herald mm-hmm. in Scotland. It's one of the only really independent papers in the whole of Britain, I would say, you know, other than the Independent in London is quite good. But David was telling me how the Israeli embassy, the day before the 7/7 bombings, had gone on to high terror alert. And yet it was supposed to be a surprise attack. Of course, Netanyahu was in London for the 7/7 bombings and supposedly got a warning. One thing's for sure, he never left his hotel when he should have done that morning, and it was a surprise attack. So Netanyahu, and also the other side that a lot of people don't know about the London attacks, is the link with Verint Systems, this part of Converse Technologies, where the boss had absconded with $13 million and was at the Securities and Exchange Commission were after him. But his company was trusted with security on the London Underground, if you can believe that. And they were the guys who had access to the tube tunnels for something like 5 months before the bombings. So, you know, you've got to ask questions about what is an Israeli security company, private security company, with a guy who's an explosives expert as its chief executive, Daniel Bodner, doing some sort of security job on the London Underground. I don't think most people on the Underground realize that's even going on. So, yes, the Israelis' fingerprints are all over this stuff, Patrick. You're absolutely right. But there is another aspect to it. You've got the US, the Israelis, and the Brits and the upping the ante with this war crime, drone war, to surpass anything that was possible from the CIA torture program. Well, we don't bother torturing anyone. We just knock them out and kill them.
Oh, yeah, that's their policy. Yeah.
And then, of course, a couple of weeks ago, there was another marriage ceremony, bang, hellfire missiles raining down everywhere and something like 35 people killed. A marriage ceremony, that's not really considered to be interesting or important because it's kind of normal. But if that was happening in Paris, you know, which it actually wasn't even as bad as that in Paris. The other thing to mention is the Germans also have a very important drone program, but it's all very, very covert. Yeah, so it's not just the Israelis, the Brits, and the Yanks that are doing this drone stuff. The Germans are playing their cards very close to their chest.
The Luftwaffe of the drone world.
Well, that's right. It's fascinating, isn't it? This story over the last week has been made me laugh, actually, that you've got not enough. They can't recruit people to fly these drones.
Yeah.
You know, which is wonderful, isn't it? You know, there's nobody. And what they'll do, of course, is they'll just switch them onto computer control.
Well, that's
will decide who to kill.
That's right. Okay. That was the big talking point from the defense industry before Christmas at one of the big conferences recently. And this was covered in Defense One. We spoke about this, I think, 2 weeks ago on the show. That they're saying, I think it's one of the main British DOD guys. I was one of the spokespeople. He said we need to identify what's keeping artificial intelligence, or what they call autonomy, from being implemented for the drones, and they're already working on it. DARPA's well advanced on this.
Well, maybe the people at DARPA should watch, I think it's called the Forbin Project, isn't it? It's a really good old 1970s feature film movie about this, I love this stuff because it's been predicted previous generations to us, Patrick, have said, look, watch out for this, guys. What happens is the computers are allowed to start to fight this war. And what happens is they just take over and wipe everybody out, you know?
Yeah, well, the autonomy is, and this was intimated at one of the drone conferences at the Excel Center in London, where they showed the screen up with a number of red dots. So they had the red dots were the heat signatures, and then the orange dots were the potential terminate with extreme prejudice targets. And then the AI system on board, the autonomous brain, if you will, in the drone will decide which of those orange dots to terminate in which order based on various algorithms, threats, inputs, data, whatever. This is the future of drones. It's not if, Tony. They're already presenting it.
We have to say, this is evil. It's not just bad technology. This is evil. It's back again. And I would reiterate, NATO was started, according to one of the top SS people, by the international supporters of the SS. That's Paul Hauser. Go look him up. He was, running the SS Veterans Association. The other thing to say is there's a lot of history has attempted to really obscure the continuity between the looted billions of Europe. That is to say, the money that the Nazis looted from all the central banks, places like that, gold, securities, all that kind of stuff. And then they secreted it away for this underground Fourth Reich network, which is, I think, what we're dealing with today. But just to try and flesh that out a little bit, there are a couple of books, both of which are terrific reads. One is by a guy called John Ainsworth Davis, and under the pen name Christopher Crichton. And he was, involved in this raid by the Brits, by Ian Fleming, and signed off by Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill, and King George VI to get Martin Bormann out from under the noses of the Russians in April 1945, a commando raid. And that book is really well worth reading. I don't think it's ever been published in the US. It's called OpJB, Operation James Bond. And Ian Fleming, of course, the James Bond writer, he put a lot of stuff into his books because after the end of the war, of course, he'd signed the Official Secrets Act, Ian Fleming had. But he wanted to write about some of the stuff that they'd been doing in the war in fictional terms. And so that's well worth a read, the OpJB book by Christopher Crichton. The other one, though, is probably more interesting to you because it's the former CBS News correspondent Paul Manning. Paul Manning had been actually flying on bombing raids over occupied Europe with the Brits, with the Americans, and was reporting back for CBS during World War II. And his swan song was this book which came out in 1982 called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And what he does there is he really puts together all of the various bits and pieces that show, that prove that Martin Bormann did survive the war, and he spent his time in Paraguay and Argentina setting up 750 corporations. Mm-hmm. He was a real administrator, Hitler's number two, basically his treasurer. And in those corporations, once he'd set them up, all the ex-SS people, supporters of the Nazis, etc., took off their swastikas, put on nice suits, and marched off into the post-war world, industrial world.
That's right, Hugo Boss suits.
Yeah, that's the ones. The thing is that Paul Manning, bless him, I mean, if you ever hear any of his reports, just amazing guy, brilliant writer. He actually had his son shot dead the week that the book was published, and his publisher had his legs broken. So, you know, you can see that there was a lot of people around that didn't want that book to come out, and there's been a real attempt to completely squash it out of history. But you can get it as a free PDF, I think, and also, you know, there are ways of getting hold of the book still. But it's a terrific read, and there it's also interesting. I found to see names in there that are still there in the Bilderberg conferences today, which I've covered over the years, and you can see that there is some kind of continuity, quite exactly what, difficult to tell, between the Bilderberg and the Nazis. And one person, you know, really stands out is Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was an SS officer. He was the chairman of Bilderberg for the first 20 years of its existence, and until 1975, when he was discredited in the Lockheed scandal, and he'd taken $1 million bribe from Lockheed, and he had to step out of the way. But Bernhard was a dyed-in-the-wool Nazi, and he denied it as well. He was
SS officer, wasn't he?
That's right. He was in the SS. He was in the Nazi party when he was at university. But somehow he married into the Dutch royal family, and he said, oh, well, I'm going to be the Dutch liaison officer for the liberation of Holland. And so he was in there with the Brits, the Americans, in a RAF uniform. as a Dutch liaison officer at the Operation Market Garden, Arnhem, you know, the Bridge Too Far film. He was involved in all that, and he was trusted as a liaison officer, even though he was an ex-SS officer. Actually, the Americans were much more sensible. They didn't trust him at all. The Brits did, for some reason, because they were told to by King George VI, and Ian Fleming talks about that too. You know, the amazing thing was that anybody trusted an ex-SS officer involved in, you know, a massive British army and American army operation. So the Admiralty wouldn't let him, didn't trust him, but the army did. And there are pictures of him actually looking over the shoulder of Monty, the Operation Market Garden. He sent a spy in to make connections with the Dutch resistance movement as a preparation for Market Garden and the liberation of Holland. And these three parachute divisions landed in A Bridge Too Far. And that guy turned out to be a Nazi agent. So, you know, just a minute, you know, there are some real big connections here. And of course, that operation ended up as a disaster. It gave the Nazis an extra 6 months, basically, of war. In order to finish their operation to squirrel away their money for the Fourth Reich after the war, the Underground Reich, which is actually, Patrick, I think what we're dealing with today. And we go back to evil. You know, the people who are running things are virtually a cult. And the only way they manage society is through the mainstream media. You know, that's the way that the only kind of the closest that people can get to any kind of truth, because we're not living in a democracy at all. We're living in a world run by these people. They just want to require more and more resources, oil. Anyone that stands in their way, like the Syrians or the Russians, are just going to get smashed, it seems. And thankfully, there is a little bit of resistance to that by other powers, but also, of course, an increasingly aware population here in the West.
I just wanted to pick up on a couple of things, Tony, that you said in the previous segment. One of them was about the terror mascots. We're coming back to the sort of Parisian frame here. The theme for today's show, by the way, if you're looking at 21stCenturyWire.com, is Semester Plan, Paris Terror. So we're getting into the master plan of the Paris attacks. Now, the terror mascot is very important. And you talked about Abu Hamza. We've also got Abu Qatada. Both of those are more or less admitted informants, even though the British intelligence denied it when commenting to the press about the Abu Hamza trial in the United States. It's pretty obvious that he was in regular contact with the British intelligence services, and Finsbury Park Mosque was a honeypot of sorts. Abu Qatada got a better deal. He got shipped off to Jordan. No time served or nothing, and he'll be coming back to the United Kingdom this year, so we're told. So another mascot, and so we have all these various what I call terror mascots. Now, I knew Abu Hamza was a mascot back in 2003. How did I know that? Well, during the anti-war marches, the Palestinian community was demonstrating, people from that community in London were demonstrating against the war. You'd expect they would anyway. And the people from Finsbury Park Mosque were coming up to the line of Palestinians when they're over at Regent's Park Mosque outside having a demo. And they said, it's haram. What you're doing is haram. This is on the eve of the Iraq war. What you're doing is haram. Now, this was told to me by one of the Palestinian students who, I knew because, he worked in the bakery that I live next door to in West London. And I said, that's weird. And he said, yeah. I said, are you sure? He said, yeah. And these were all Abu Hamza's foot soldiers. And I thought, well, he has to be, you know, what's going on there in Finsbury Park, you know? So, but of course, this is all gone over the heads of the media, as has the Sydney Sheikh, the Sheikh Monis, Harun Monis in Sydney. That's gone over the heads of the media. He was a mascot as well, had a brilliant media presence. I mean, News Corporation milked Abu Hamza. I mean, he's one of the greatest all-time character actors in the history of this particular series of drama. But so now we have the creation of the myth in Paris, and we have the Bonnie and Clyde myth with the two Koulibaly and Hayat, his alleged girlfriend. photos were released of her in a veil with a crossbow, which we have on the site today, and also her with a fake gun or a paintball gun or something. You talked about the paintball sessions there. That's interesting. That's probably where those photos were taken. You have no way of confirming, Tony, whether this girlfriend is actually the girl in the photographs of the full burqa with the gun and the crossbow. You have no way of telling because you're covered, just like you have no way of telling the shooters are the same people they're putting up as the perps, the Kawashi brothers. You don't know. And in fact, the Kawashi brothers, if most North African average build is usually quite short, they look like they're maybe short and stocky. The shooters were 6'1", muscular, like soldiers, basically, and handling guns. And if you, handling a real Kalashnikov is not like, casting a fly fishing rod. Okay. Those are heavy. Just to work those guns, you have to be a certain physical stature. You have to be strong.